Good morning. I'm Sharon Leon from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. And I'd like to welcome you to the first Object of History audio cast concerning the short-handled hoe. The Object of History is a joint project of the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History that provides students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from NMAH's collection. Our focus for today is the Cesar Chavez family short-handled hoe. And we're joined by two guests today, a curator and a historian. First, our first guest is Stephen Petey from Yale University. He's a professor of History and American Studies and the director of the program in Ethnicity, Race, and Migration at Yale. Stephen received his PhD from Stanford in 1998 and is the author of The Devil in Silicon Valley, Race, Mexican Americans, and Northern California in 2003. And he's got two projects forthcoming, one on Cesar Chavez and one about race in California. He teaches graduate and undergraduate courses in Latino studies, ethnic studies, Western history, 20th century immigration, civil rights, and related subjects. So we're happy to have Stephen with us today. Our other guest today is Peter Leibold, who is chair and curator of the Division of Work and Industry at NMAH. Peter's research specialties and interests include the culture of work, management practice, manufacturing technology, methods and motivations of technological change. His current project is on the Bracero program, which existed from 1942 to 1964. It's called Bittersweet Harvest. Welcome to both of you. We've got a lot of questions today from students around the country about the short-handled hoe. And I think that we would start our list today with a great question from a high school student in Oregon named Becca. And I think this is probably a question for you, Peter. Becca wants to know, how young were people accepted to the Bracero program? Were they accepting teenagers? Were they only accepting people over 18? Is a Bracero worker perhaps a teenager?
Well, the Bracero program was highly regulated, and there were many rules to protect the workers. So child labor was not an issue long as the program rules were followed. And while there were many concerns about it, age was one that I think was rarely seen as an issue. I'm sure that some people may have lied about their age and been a bit too young to work. But generally speaking, while there's a lot of child labor in agriculture, in the Bracero program per se, there was not.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Stephen, we have a question here from Rachel in South Carolina, and she wants to know whether, as far as migrant workers were concerned, was there a lot of child labor then, as we sort of tend to associate them with migrant labor now?
Yes, I mean,
were there a lot of children working in the fields?
That's a terrific question. The answer to that is yes, there were a lot of children working into the very recent past, and one still sees children in some areas of the country working in agricultural work in some numbers. In the past, as you might imagine, children worked primarily to support their family's economy. So children would go to the fields along with their parents, along with their older siblings, in order to help pick cotton, to help weed plants that needed to be weeded in order to allow them to grow to their healthy and mature sizes. In other words, to help bring in a little bit of extra money to allow families that were struggling economically as members of the migrant stream to make do, to pay their monthly costs in gas, in housing, and food, and so forth. So the problem of child labor was actually very significant throughout the majority of the 20th century, really into the 1970s, at which point it really began to subside significantly. And this, of course, had a real effect on children's education. The kids who were working significantly in the field were oftentimes not in school or not in school for the 10 months or 9 months out of the year in which other kids were in school. So in addition to the health problems that this posed for kids, the fact that they were working so much at such a young age, this also had a significant effect on their schooling.
And was child labor a significant focus of the United Farm Workers in their efforts to improve conditions?
I would call it a secondary focus of the United Farm Workers. It was part of the United Farm Workers' concerns from the early 1960s forward. It never sort of took center stage in the United Farm Workers as a kind of primary call for change. For a couple of reasons. One was that there were other reformers in American society who were already very concerned about that issue. And in some sense, I think Cesar Chavez and others involved in that organization felt that message was already being carried by other people. And secondly, I think that there were as one might imagine, farm workers who were very concerned about any call to end child labor precisely because so it seems strange to us now, precisely because those adults felt, you know, that they really did need their children to work in order to make the family economy survive. And if children were pulled out of the fields against families' wills, people felt that this would only further impoverish those migrants themselves. In other words, so it was something of a sticky issue, I think, within some of these migrant communities. And though the UFW did statements on that issue, I think they generally try to skirt it.
Very good. Peter, can you tell us a little bit about how and when agricultural labor became important to the collections of the museum?
Well, the Smithsonian has always been interested in agriculture because it's such an important part of American history that certainly this is a country that was founded on agriculture, and the collections here are very, very rich in terms of artifacts of tractors and combines and things like that. But it's only in the last 10 or 20 years that historians, both here in the Smithsonian, I think more broadly, have really started to look at a broader sense of who's actually working, taking much more of an interest in the social history of farm labor, of not just the farms and the equipment, but the relationship of the people that are working on for pay, not the farm owners themselves.
And can you tell us who of these agricultural workers would have used the short-handle hoe?
Short-handle hoes, interesting, are not used throughout the country. They're predominantly in the Southwest. We know that they're heavily used in the Salinas Valley and the Coachella Valley, to some degree in Arizona. But you see a scattering of uses of short-handled hoes elsewhere. But they would be used by field laborers for cultivation.
Very good. And Stephen, do you have a sense of sort of the place of the short-handled hoe in the cultural memory of the Latino community in California? Is this something that is sort of still alive in the memory of that community?
I think absolutely. I think it's particularly for folks who lived through the 1960s and 1970s. In other words, people that would be older than today's high school students, there is a strong memory of what the short-handled hoe meant. It was taken to be a symbol of the difficulties of the hardships facing farm workers in California and in the Southwest. It was taken to be an instrument of oppression, of something that required tremendous exertion and hunching over that had very, very deleterious effects on the bodies of the men and the women who were forced to work with it for generations. And as a result, I mean, one still encounters people in California who will tell stories about back problems, the lumbar problems that they experienced as from their childhoods forward, and of course that were aggravated as they got older as a result of their work with this very, very difficult tool to use. So the answer to the question is that yes, there is of course a really strong memory, I think, of this tool and of the efforts to abolish it, which, as you know, happened in 1975 finally, and that were taken as a real victory for the United Farm Workers and for Mexican Americans and for farm workers more generally.
Very good.
I don't think you can underestimate the symbolic importance of the short handle hoe. It's important. One observation would be that Cesar Chavez kept a short handle hoe on the shelf behind his desk in his office. So it was always there to remind him and to remind people who came to visit him of the difficult things that had to be overcome.
Very
That's
good.
Right.
And is this hoe that hoe, the hoe that he kept on the shelf behind his desk in his office?
No, but Cesar Chavez's office is actually really quite intact, and that hoe still sits there today. The Chavez family had more than one hoe, and this hoe was presented by the family to the Smithsonian. So I would say that there were probably many different hoes that different family members were using.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Can you tell us a little bit more about that story, about how the hoe came into the collection, the circumstances of its collection?
Well, it's an interesting story. The Smithsonian was doing a traveling exhibition, really taking its treasures around the country on the 150th birthday of the museum. And one of the icons in our collection is a jacket that Cesar Chavez wore, a baseball-style jacket with the UFW patch. The kind of all the officers in the union had these jackets, and he would wear this quite often. And so we included in this exhibition, and when the show traveled to San Jose, Chavez family members were really so excited to see it, see that their artifact, their piece of history, had the same importance as many other great pieces, that they felt that they should add more to the collection and chose to to donate the one of the family hoes, short handle hoes, to the museum. Now, it's interesting, when people donate objects quite often, they clean them up, shine them up, sometimes chrome plate them. Museums really hate that. They really like to have the patina of age on it. The Chavez family actually did do one thing to their hoe. They didn't knock off the dirt or rust or anything like that, but they sharpened it. And I think it's a real, I think it's fascinating because it is a work tool. And a hoe, like anything else, needs to be sharp. And they wanted to make sure that their family hoe was a tool ready to be used, even if it was something that they fought hard to keep from being used.
Very, very interesting. Stephen, we know that you're somewhat of an expert on Chavez, and I was wondering if you could tell students a little bit about his early life and maybe some influences that would have pushed him towards being the major activist that he turned out to be as an adult.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, he had a very, of course, interesting and rich life, one that connects with many broad themes in American history in the 20th century. Cesar Chavez was born in 1927 in the Yuma, Arizona area. This is the far southwestern corner of Arizona, right where it abuts California. He was born on the family homestead, a family farm that was taken out by his grandparents, who were immigrants. Cesar Chavez was not himself an immigrant. It was his grandparents' generation that arrived from Mexico to the United States in the 1890s. He had a number of brothers and sisters and lived from 1927 forward in relative comfort in the first few years of his life. He was living on a family farm, a farm that grew watermelons and other kinds of melons, that raised chickens and that was able to provide a real sustenance for the family. But like so many other Americans in the 1930s, the Chavez family were victims of the economic depression, and his parents lost the farm to creditors, you know, when Chavez was about 9 years old. And so Chavez, along with Dust Bowl migrants coming from Oklahoma and Arkansas and elsewhere in the Midwest, joined the movement of people going to California in the late 1930s, who went to California, the Golden State, as agricultural workers, as migrant workers. So the Chavez family experienced a sharp downward decline in their social fortunes, going from, you know, sort of lower middle class but somewhat comfortable and independent to being, you know, among the poorest of America. And the Chavez family lived as migrant workers from their arrival in California into the mid-1940s, at which time, right after World War II, Cesar Chavez joined the Navy and served in the Navy for nearly 2 years. And he returned to get married in the late 1940s after the Navy. And then in 1952, in the city of San Jose, California, which folks may know is south of San Francisco and is the kind of heart of the Silicon Valley area, which has given us the computer industry and software industry. Chavez became actively involved in the Catholic Church and in civil rights. And he became a kind of civil rights, one of the most important, perhaps the most important Mexican-American civil rights activist in 1950 California, working on voter registration, on urging non-U.S. citizens to become U.S. citizens, so that they could vote and participate fully in U.S. society, and so forth. In the early 1960s, he decided it was far more important to really take up the cause of farm workers. His family had, of course, when he was a child, been farm laborers, and he actually continued to have back pain himself and suffered tremendous back pain in his adult life because of his use of the short-handled hoe as a younger person. And so in 1962, he set about to organize a farm labor union, which would become, in later years, the United Farm Workers, with which many people are familiar now.
Very good. Interesting. So the world of Cesar Chavez includes the world of agricultural labor. How much of that world includes also bracero workers?
Certainly there were, between 1942 and 1964, there were a lot of bracero workers. There were about 4.5 million contracts let, which means there were probably about 2 million different individuals. It's hard to know how many, because many people came on multiple contracts. It certainly isn't exactly the same number. But agriculture itself is gigantic. So even if you have 2 million braceros, agriculture is so large that that you're talking about many more people in areas like California, where agriculture is so important. There are distinctly during the bracero period different groups. You have migrant workers, people who are traveling along with the crops. You have local workers who are working in agriculture but are staying in the area. And then you would have the braceros as well, who are guest workers who were brought in. They were brought in to work in a specific area on specific contracts. So they might short of 6 weeks, sometimes for 3 to 6 months.
Can I just add one thing, which is that it's important in thinking about the bracero program for students to know that California was the largest recipient of bracero workers from 1942 to 1964, but braceros also went to many other states in the United States. They worked in the Pacific Northwest, they worked in the upper Midwest, they worked in Texas and parts of the South. In fact, California was the number one state. I think Texas was number two, and the state that received the third largest number of braceros was the state of Arkansas, surprisingly, which was very much shaped in the modern period by the arrival of Mexican workers in the 1950s in particular.
Very interesting. Stephen, we have a question that I think probably is best directed at you. It's from Chris in Illinois, and it sort of connects to some things that you were saying earlier. And the question is, did the peaceful demonstrations done by the UFW ever yield violent reactions from the police or the public, as did some other civil rights demonstrations at the time?
Well, I think the answer to that from the United Farm Workers side is absolutely yes. That they did receive they were the recipients of real violence from sheriffs in rural counties in California, from the Texas Rangers in South Texas when the United Farm Workers attempted to organize a union of farm workers who were working in the cantaloupe field in South Texas in 1966 and 1967, and others, private citizens who were very angry at the arrival of those they saw as dangerous radicals, perhaps linked to the Black Panthers, as many people saw them in this period. I guess one of the interesting things, though, is that the greatest amount of violence directed at the United Farm Workers during these years was actually came at the hands of other unionists. It was the Teamsters Union that was fighting to control, to bring in agricultural workers as well during the 1970s that really inflicted the greatest personal damage on farm workers during the 1970s. The 1970s was an extremely bloody period for the USW, and most of that blood was drawn by Teamsters unionists and not sheriffs or police or private citizens.
Very interesting. That was a good question. We have, sort of some other questions along those lines. And Peter, you and I have talked about this some, about what you feel sort of the connection between the Bracero program and the sort of beginnings of successes for the UFW, what that connection might be.
Well, it was important to end the Bracero program to effectively organize farm workers. As a potential pool of strikebreakers, the most people recognized that the Braceros could be brought in and really take away the strike possibilities for local farm workers. So you see people like labor activists like Ernesto Galarza advocating very strongly for the end of the Bracero program, partially because of issues of exploitation of the workers themselves, but also because he perceived as the Bracero program as being a safety valve for the agricultural interests, that as long as the program was in place, it would be very, very difficult to organize farm laborers.
Very good.
I can add something there if you want. Ernesto Galarza worked to try to organize farm workers into a union in California, the same fields where Cesar Chavez and others had great success in the 1960s. Galarza worked from 1947 until 1961 trying to do the same thing. He had different methods, different approaches. Which might and that in some way might explain his inability to carry out the program. But the biggest problem he faced really was the Bracero workforce. And what Galarza experienced for that long 14-year period was that every time he tried to organize workers into a union, those workers once they spoke to him were fired and replaced by new workers, principally Braceros. So it was the obstacle to local workers who were interested in improving their situation to being able to do that in the years before the abolition of the program in 64, 65.
That's very interesting. We have a lot of questions actually about the Bracero program, and I think that it's something that students aren't terribly familiar with, if they've even heard of it ever before. We have this question from Beth in Massachusetts, which I think is a really good one, and it is, if conditions were originally put in place to protect the Bracero workers when the program was established, and I assume she means through the contracts, why weren't there, or actually were there, a set of officials in charge of enforcing those conditions? Peter, was there any sense of enforcement of contract conditions for Bracero?
Well, of course, that's a really great question, and it's a question that transcends just Bracero workers, but any kind of workers, that there are a huge number of governmental regulations in place, and often it's not a shortage of laws, but a shortage of enforcement. If you can look at the apparel industry, the number of of enforcers in the apparel industry is so small that, sweatshops proliferate today because operators know that their chances of being inspected are extremely slim. There was the workers themselves could they had communication with their with the Mexican consul and they could report problems. It was unlikely that people would report problems because if they did, it would mean that they would be sent back home. It would be rare that the problem would be fixed and they would continue to work. So the incentive for reporting issues was really not very great because it probably meant that you would not be allowed to continue to work. And of course, this is the same problem that we see with the H-2 contracts, H-2A and H-2B workers. Any kind of guest worker program, it makes it very difficult for the workers themselves to be the people who are triggering the action.
One of the I'll just throw in another thing. One of the other things that also contributed was the geography of rural areas, and in particular the geography of rural California. California in the 20th century, rural California, the Great Central Valley in particular, but also some of the coastal growing areas, which are among the great agricultural producers of crops in the entire world over the last 100 years and more. These are farmlands that are controlled by very large plots of land that are controlled by large farmholding corporations and wealthy agribusinesses and wealthy farmers. And what that means is that braceros were living in farm labor camps that were quite removed from one another and quite removed from the cities and towns of California oftentimes. They're living on plots of land that extend for miles and miles and miles, that are connected to the local town by a long dirt road and then a long rural highway. And so part of the answer to the question about enforcement has to do with the inability of braceros to find people who might have addressed their complaints, if indeed they were brave enough to take the risk of making those complaints. Oftentimes it was difficult for those people to actually make their way to a place in which they might have been able to complain or to raise the attention someone's attention about their local condition.
Interesting. Very good. There's an awful lot of material on the site about the campaign to ban the short-handled hoe. And I have a question here from Grace in Oregon who wants to know if there have been cases of the short-handled hoe being used illegally after the California Supreme Court made its declaration, which I think is a great question. But I wonder, Peter, if you can give us a little bit of background to that about the campaign to ban the short-handled hoe.
Well, the problem with the short-handled hoe, of course, was that it led very directly to significant physical damage to the workers. Back injury was really quite often accompanied the use of the short-handled hoe. The campaign moved along the lines of calling it a unsafe tool. In some respects, you might call this a technical fix rather than just banning its use, passing a law. I don't think there was much of a chance of that. That the activist community realized that if they could convince people that it was truly dangerous, then it would be not allowed to be used. And that was the approach that they took. It was a good legal strategy. To do that, they had to Mojardin and others had to create a body of information to convince the labor boards that, in fact, it was a dangerous tool and shouldn't be used. There are, of course, many dangerous tools that workers use, and safety guards are put in place. In the case of the short-handled hoe, the growers, would acknowledge that there was some danger associated with it, but that it was very necessary, so that it was danger that would be acceptable. It was very important to do surveys to document the medical disabilities, to compare regions where people were not using the short handle hoe with the areas that they were, and show that there were other solutions to cultivation needs that would not require such a dangerous tool.
Very good. Stephen, was the short-handled hoe a target for the UFW?
Yes, it was. I mean, Chavez said by the 1970s that, you know, it was one of his greatest hopes that the short-handled hoe, the use of the short-handled hoe, would be abolished. You know, the United Farm Workers had so many things on their mind and so many pressing challenges from the time they began in the early 1960s that the short-handled hoe was on the list. But the United Farm Workers was not the organization that took the lead in abolishing the short-handled hoe. They worked with another organization and contributed and helped out. But the organization that took the lead was a group of lawyers who were independent of the United Farm Workers, a group called the California Rural Legal Assistance, which was an outgrowth of Great Society era legal activism, of legal strategists who worked to bring legal justice and to help in the kind of day-to-day legal problems of rural people in California. So it really was less a story of Cesar Chavez or Dolores Huerta or the others who were the leadership of the United Farm Workers bringing the short-handled hoe to an end, to abolishing it. It was less about that than it was about the work of the lawyers in the California Rural Legal Assistance working with farm workers themselves to try to end this. And the lead lawyer in that case, as Peter already said, was a man named Mo Jourdain, who really argued the case before the California government and later the California Supreme Court.
Very good. In the case of the 1965 grape boycott, though, we have a lot of pieces on the site and information about the attempts of the UFW to engage the larger public in this struggle. And I'm wondering, Stephen, if you can sort of tell us a little bit about those efforts and how successful they were, how coordinated they were, or how sort of spontaneous they were from general union members.
I would say, there are a couple things. I mean, they were very highly coordinated for the 1960s. This is, of course, a pre-internet age, and one can only imagine how much more coordinated something like a boycott of an agricultural product on a massive scale would be today, when people who were trying to coordinate something like that could make use of the web and email and so forth. But it was a very highly coordinated campaign, and it was a campaign that emerged within 2 years of the beginning of the grape strike. First to target certain brands of wine, and then later to target all grapes coming out of California. This was done for a number of reasons, but the primary reason was that those who were trying to organize the farm worker union in California felt strongly that they could not possibly win if consumers did not help them out. If the men and the women who made their family purchases each week at the local supermarket didn't themselves make a choice to back farm workers, to stand with farm workers in their efforts to improve their wages and working conditions. The farm labor union was simply convinced, Chavez was simply convinced, that they would lose on a local level, that they had no chance if they didn't bring consumers in to also apply pressure to the employers, to the large business firms that were controlling agricultural production in California. And so what happened was that the union directed its members and its volunteers throughout the country, and even volunteers coming from Canada and from Europe, to set up shop in all of the major cities of North America, to try to convince consumers that each place in Dubuque, Iowa, in New York City, in Chicago, in Atlanta, in Washington, D.C., in Seattle, and so forth, to try to stop, to urge consumers at the supermarket, in the parking lots around the supermarket, not to buy grapes until the United Farm Workers conflict had ended. There was a highly coordinated campaign attempting to direct pressure against the growers in that way, and I think it really was very successful, and it was because of the political savvy of the organizers themselves and their capacities as organizers that the grapes really fell out of fashion among many consumers, to the point that by the early 1960s, the union estimated, actually an independent marketing firm estimated that more than 6 million Americans had stopped buying grapes as a result of the campaign.
That's a tremendous impact.
Tremendous impact. I think it really was a combination of the work of farm workers themselves in California and the work of farm workers and their supporters in urban supermarkets that led the farm workers to achieve the grape contracts in 1970, almost 5 years after the strike had began.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Peter.
Oh, I was going to say, it's important in thinking about this to sort of understand the context of the times as well. Steve earlier talked about the legal campaign against the short handled hoe is coming out of the Great Society programs, which is absolutely right and really an important thing to frame this. But you also need to be thinking about the fact that this is during a time of significant interest in civil rights, and you can't really separate these campaigns from other civil rights actions. So it's really building upon some of the country's sensibilities and reactions towards freedom riders in the South. There's a transference to empowering and helping out Mexican American farm laborers in California.
Very good. And that's a really nice tie into our last featured object, the Greensboro lunch counter, and sort of the beginning of direct action nonviolence to fight segregation. The question I was going to ask here is about displaying the short-handled hoe and whether it has been on display, whether it has been on display in the context of the grape workers' strike, sort of what is the breadth of ways in which the short-handled hoe has been on display?
It has been on display a few times here at the Smithsonian, and actually has been loaned out several times. One of the things that we're always pleased is when museums around the country seek to use our collections, that we like to have things available to the public. So it has been displayed on numerous different occasions.
Very good. And are there plans for it to be on display again?
There are a tremendous number of different exhibition proposals being put forth right now. The National Museum of American History is closed for renovation, and we're planning on reopening in July of 08, and working on several different exhibitions. The short handle hoe is one that people are competing to use, that really is seen as an iconic object. So I'm pretty comfortable that it will be available to the public when the museum reopens.
Very good. I have one sort of final question here for today from Tony in Virginia, who actually wants to know, when the short-handled hoe is not on display, where does the museum keep it? This is sort of a really good behind-the-scenes question about what curators do and preservation and those sorts of things. What kinds of measures do you take with things like the short-handled hoe to preserve them and store them?
Well, we're very careful with our collections. We're in the business of perpetuity, and we take that very seriously, that artifacts, a very small percentage are ever on exhibition at any one given moment. There are over 3 million artifacts in the collection, and of course it would take much larger museum to display all of those artifacts. So there are many things that are carefully stored in acid-free containers in climate-controlled situations so that they won't rust and deteriorate. It's probably important to note that we have more than one short-handled hoe, that we have the Chavez family hoe. We have another hoe used by a farm worker in California, and recently acquired a short-handled hoe from an ex-bracero worker from the Coachella Valley. So we have several different hoes, and each one has its own story. Along with preserving the object itself, it's very important to preserve the use history, the personal history, to know about the people that used it, what their experiences were like, and keep that provenance very strong.
Very good. One final question for you, Stephen. I'm sure that you've taught this subject a lot in your years with graduate students and undergraduates. Do you have a particular, like, a favorite source that you like to use in teaching about the UFW and the farm worker movement?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are a number of things. I mean, if one is interested in the short-handled hoe, there's really only one thing that I think students can read, and that's the memoir of Maurice Jourdain, Mo Jourdain, who was the lawyer who helped, who brought the legal case that ended its use in California. So that's a useful thing that I tell my students about, and I would tell anybody about. It's very accessible. It's a quick and easy, good read. There's a nice film about the United Farm Workers with an accompanying book. The film and the book are called The Fight in the Fields. They came out about 10 years ago. The result of a lot of independent research by the filmmakers. So this film, The Fight in the Fields, is a nice both visual resource and sort of a way of getting into some of the materials about the United Farm Workers. You can sort of see Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, Jessica Gouveia, and others involved in the movement speaking on screen, and also read about them if you want to go deeper in the book. So, you know, I'd suggest those two things are really useful, not just for college students, but for any member of the general public, any high school student interested in these topics.
Great. That's a really nice way for our listeners to sort of go beyond the materials that are available to them on the site. And a nice way for us to end today, because we're just about out of time. And I'd like to thank Peter Leopold and Stephen Peaty for joining us today. I think that we've had an excellent discussion, and we've gotten some great insights into the world of the short-handled hoe and the workers who used it, and Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers. We do have another conversation on the board here, where for listeners who are looking to join us later in the month, we'll be back on April 20th at 10 minutes after 10 Eastern Time. So we're still dealing with our East Coast listeners. And then a little bit later in the month, we'll switch to the afternoon, so hopefully we can get some questions from some West Coast students. I want to thank you all for joining us today and exploring the object of history.